Hello, hello, this is Alex Burkett, and you are listening to the Long Game Podcast. In this episode, I'm chatting with Ryan McCready. Ryan is the managing editor at Reforge. Previously, he was at Foundation, and before that, Vengage. In this conversation, we did a deep dive into thought leadership, even presenting a new definition or hypothesis as to what thought leadership actually is. Basically, we figured that hot takes are the bedrock of thought leadership because they're hard to fake. They're either based on years of expertise and experience or on novel data and insights, and they tend to generate conversation. We also covered how to work with experts, the value of redefining terminology in search terms and SEO, and how to distribute content outside of SEO. This was an awesome conversation. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Ryan McCready.
You guys at Reforge, let's start here. You guys at Reforge, you're writing for an advanced audience, or at least it's not like the mainstream, let's say like Neil Patel, like that broad of an umbrella.
Yeah.
So there's naturally going to be less keyword search volumes. In fact, you guys are making new terms, right? Like growth loop was not a thing people talked about before. So you don't probably have that benefit of being able to rely on a huge space that has a lot of demand already.
Yeah.
And also it's like in a lot of these heavy keyword spaces, the highest traffic terms are going to be catered towards beginners, right?
100%.
Content marketing definition. What is content? What is growth? And those things are pretty upstream of probably your target audience.
Yep.
So has that been challenging coming in and doing content at Reforge?
1000%. Because I came at Vengage. We were that designer beginning kind of thing. We were looking for those people who had no design experience. They were searching for things like and a report template, stuff like that. It's very actionable, but it's very low level. It's not like and a report PSD where we knew they were going to use Photoshop or something like that. We knew that they were coming through. We knew that they wanted to they needed a template because they didn't have any design experience and they needed to create something quickly. So we fit in that very well. But coming to Reforge, it's like everyone is at mid to advanced level. And there's maybe 100 people searching each month, according to Ahrefs or whatever metric you want to use, for some of those keywords that we are very, very well versed in. There's a piece that we have that's called "Crossing the Career Canyon" for product managers, I believe. And one keyword that I saw that would be great for that is product lead versus product manager. There is a difference between it, and it actually broke it down. But again, there's only 100 people searching for that each month. It's not the 10,000 search volume that if you get there, you can drive a ton of revenue. It's like we got to pick our battles and be like, do we want to be number one on this? Like for growth loops, like you said, we want to be number one for that. For stuff that we're known for, we want to be number one, even if it's 200, even if it's under 500 monthly searches. So it's been a little bit difficult to switch my mindset from big keywords equal big value equal big revenue and write content around there and switch to something that's more like, we just want to be where these people are as we continue to build our brand and continue to expand. I will let you in on a little thing that we're testing. So like you said, the keywords that are like, what is something? We want to go after that, but reinvent what the answers are, because we have this massive collection of experts underneath us. So we can ask them, what is X? And they'll give us a better answer than anything that that's sitting in Google right now, number one for let's just say, what is marketing? So there's some very vague tech like that. We can do what is marketing in 2022 and get 30 good answers from all of our experts and build a piece around that. And what's great about that is I've been saying this where people want to rank their content number one. So they pretend to be experts in that content. We have experts in that content, in that niche, in that cross-functional or not cross-functional, in that role that people want to hear about. So we don't have to fake it. We can just write about it and it'll give us a lot of boost. And we can also pitch it very easily to get guest posts. The people that are writing for us help build massive companies. They're very well known. So that is one big thing that has helped me kind of strategize our SEO going forward is we have all these levers that we can pull. We just haven't touched them yet.
I mean, you guys also have a pretty high domain rating, right? And a pretty well-built audience. So you're not coming up, you know, against HubSpot for what is marketing from like this place from scratch. You've got assets.
Yeah, 100%. Because that's what I keep talking to people like outside of the marketing. Like when you come to a company and you're building an SEO strategy, you're usually going from like 0 to 100. We're going from like 50 or 75 to 100. We have all the pieces in place. We just need to like move them in the right, put them in the right order, and kind of pull those levers that haven't been touched before.
Have you heard of this? I love that you touched on the point of like these SERPs not being representative of what actually experts would define a term as. Yeah. There's some term for like when you read a newspaper, it's like the Gelman amnesia effect or something like that, where if you're an expert in a topic area and you read a story on that, you start to see all these holes and like these inaccuracies. And yet tomorrow you read another story on a topic you're not an expert in and you totally forget about that, right? Yeah. Because I've had this happen where I would Google something around conversion rate optimization or experimentation. Yeah. And I'm like, that's not right. Like, yeah, that's not the definition. That's not how you run an A/B test. But like, because these sites have high domain ratings, or maybe they started writing in, you know, 2006, like they've occupied the space. And then there's this sort of arms race or snowball effect where all the new writers cite that. They try to, you know, make it 200 words longer or whatever it is, but it all reflects that same kind of search intent. And now all of a sudden you have to fit in the search intent that doesn't accurately describe the concept that you were writing about in the first place. There's sort of a battle there, but you guys are hoping to overcome that with experts.
Yeah. I think we're just going to come in and smash it. I think as you saw with like the core update, we're seeing some, I don't know how much you guys are in like personal SEO or more client stuff, but we're seeing like the stuff that we're known for, we're just like surging up the charts, surging up the rankings. And that's kind of where I thought SEO is going to be moving. Like the experts, the people writing it, the Adam Fishmans, the very smart people of product. If we're writing about that, Google's going to give us so much more, so many more SERPs, so many more, a bigger audience, I guess, because I think they're tired of being almost made fun of for what is keywords looking exactly the same. Cause that, I mean, eventually, like the cost per click and all that stuff that they're running on ads on, it's going to get either too high or they're not going to be see returns from it. So people are going to be shifting their stuff. So I'm wondering if that continues, just the expert driven, the expert written, all that stuff, who can prove that they're an expert, is really going to shine above these ghost written articles that have been there for 6 years and they slightly tweak it with, oh, we got some marketing stats from 2022. Oh wait, they were quoted in 2016. Oh wait, it's from an article in 2008. Oh wait, it's from 1991. Like there's a couple stats that are like 20 years old that marketers keep quoting.
Oh yeah. The email marketing, it's like for every dollar you invest, you make $50 back. It's
yeah.
Like, who did that study? How long ago was it? And which email marketing company was it?
Yeah. As much as I love Buffer, they have one where it's like images or social posts with images get 2x interaction, and it was ran in like 2012. And it was like a very small subset of like not that many tweets. And I'm like, it probably is, but.
Like, I've ripped on a Buffer tweet or a Buffer blog post about A/B testing actually many times. So they're probably tired of me citing them, but they're getting links from it. So whatever, but it was an A/B test, but it was a horribly run A/B test. And yet they rank for this term, like how to run an A/B test. And it was, like you said, it was two tweets, with very low sample size. And they were looking at like six different metrics and some were down and some were up. And they're like, all right, this one's up. So this one's the winner. Therefore we extrapolate that. And this, it was like some image thing. It's like images get better retweets.
Yeah. And like, you'll see that on a lot of like visually driven companies, you'll see that pop up like, oh, you need to create images for social because this, and it's that, it's from Buffer or whatever. Again, love Buffer, love what they're doing. It's just, it's percolated so far from that original test that it might need to be updated.
Yeah. So you're making the case for something like topical authority or topical expertise. But I think a lot of people might hear that and say, okay, I'll just write a bunch of topics on this, interlink them. But you're saying there's more of a base and underlying expertise that has to has to be included there. It's not just,
yes,
if I wanted to build some topical authority, I go research a bunch of blog posts about X topic, even though I'm not an expert and don't have any credibility in that space.
Yeah. So one thing that came out last week, which we're kind of rebuilding our blog, and we're putting a big emphasis on the authors, because we have some of the best in the business that coin these awesome frameworks and stuff like that that people love, and we could be doing a lot better at promoting them and just connecting those experts to those terms. But we're putting a big emphasis on like author pages, because Google just put something out, I think it was last week, where it's like, here's how to correctly structure your author pages and like how to tag them correctly. And here's all the things you need. And it's like, we're almost going to build like mini LinkedIn posts or mini LinkedIn profiles for each of our authors, just to show they're an expert in this because they've been in the product field for 15 years. They work for all these companies. They got their degree. They got a master's. They got an MBA. They got all these different things, instead of like, this guy wrote about product 50 times in the last year. He is not an expert. He might be great at it, but these people have done the work and built out companies. I mean, one thing that we like to throw around, which I'm hoping becomes more used by more people in the space, is like frontier knowledge. It's like the people who are building companies and they pick up those frameworks, and a lot of those frameworks are trapped in their heads, but our blog, our programs allow them to pull it out and teach it to a bunch of different people. So those are the experts that I want to talk to that have been there, that have done that, not just really read about it or regurgitated something that another person wrote 5 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, that's the stuff that I like reading. That's why I go on Hacker News, and a lot of people are now searching, you know, site:Reddit for their topic instead of just going to Google, because they want some fresh, interesting stuff written by people who've done it.
Yeah.
And that was what I used to do at CXL too. I would source experts for their articles that I would write. I would treat it, this phrase is maybe a little overused now, treat it like a journalist. You know, I would go out and ask questions. I would have some viewpoint that I would maybe start with, a hypothesis. But I would include different experts, and maybe there would be some nuance and some confusion and maybe alternate takes, but sprinkling those throughout the piece, or just having them write, you know, in the edit, and like basically just pushing their voice out, like you were saying. Yeah. So I think it's an interesting space to be in. It's a very unique one for content marketers. I don't think a lot of us are there, because a lot of us don't have such a pool of experts to pull from, and also like a dearth of search volume. So it's quite unique.
Yeah. And just like I haven't been at Reforge super long, but like two of the articles that I wrote took that exact same approach. I was a journalist. I talked to, I think it was 7 experts about managing up. And I had these hot takes of like, being a director is the worst role at any company, because you're stuck in this like meat grinder of communications. And I'm like, react to this. And like, we got a great article about that. And it was opposing. I mean, there was only, I think, one of those 5 hot takes where it was like unanimous. We're like, yes, we agree with this. But most of them were like, no, because of this, or yes, because of that. And we got that kind of like almost debate structure going, and people loved it. And it wasn't that hard of a piece of content to produce, because we leveraged what we already had, which are those experts. And then we just kind of had to, like you said, be a journalist and stitch it all together into a cohesive narrative.
I'm going to ask you some nitty gritty stuff about this specific article. So where did you get the idea for that piece?
So it's funny. So about 2 months ago, I was watching, we have a lot of like live events that we do, and we record them, and then we cut them up in the clips for just like member engagement and emails and stuff like that. And I was watching one put on by Matt Greenberg, which is our CTO. And he's just a great guy, but he also has some very great hot takes on stuff. And as I was watching it, I was like, oh, these are great. Cause like the director one was from him. And then he said something like, time is your biggest opportunity in your career, so don't get stuck on dead end projects. And I'm like, yep, that's a great one. Mm-hmm. And then I just was watching those clips, and I'm like, okay, we can turn this into an article, because they are kind of controversial. And I've been taught to kind of lean into the controversy. I mean, I love making, the first article I wrote for Bengage was titled, it was like, young people, oh, this is what I was, millennials are the problem, comma, you're just old. And it was like a bunch of data on like, actually millennials are pretty similar to like the past generation when it comes to like education, marriage, all that stuff. And that took off because it just, it kind of played into that controversy. So I like leaning into being a little controversial because it gets people talking. And I knew that there was something we could do with this. I didn't know what it looked like, but I knew that we had this collection of experts, these EIRs, everyone that would respond to it and throw in like, what's great about it is they didn't just respond. They added like a second layer of like, if you're stuck in a position that you don't like, here's how you can change it. Here's how you can adapt to it. And if it doesn't work, then you can leave. But they gave us like some really good information on like how to improve your managing up skills too, not just like very base level, like, no, this is wrong. It's like, I don't agree. Here's how you can change it.
Okay. I have a hypothesis and you can either accept or reject this hypothesis.
Yeah.
So hot takes are A, hard to fake because you're either basing it in years of expertise and experience, yeah, or they're coming from data, novel data that you've seen.
Yep.
And therefore, hot takes are the bedrock of all thought leadership.
Yep. I would say, yeah, I would say that's a really good way to kind of frame it. Yeah, because you want, with these hot takes, you're usually pushing against like a pretty commonly held narrative. And people, it's when you kind of go against that, you get the most unique and the most like real reactions to it. Like I remember Adam Fishman was like, for the director role, he's like, yeah, this is terrible. And that's all he said. And I was like, okay, can you elaborate on that? And he's like, yeah, it's you're managing up and down the entire time, all that stuff. But it's just, you get those visceral reactions that people like to read about instead of like the wishy-washy stuff that so much content is now.
So what do you do if you're in a director role? Do you just try to get out as fast as you can?
So, I think who said this, but it was basically like, you exist as director and you just upskill as fast as you can. You learn how to communicate up, you learn how to communicate down, you get all these skills that'll help you, and then you leave. Like it's gonna be tough, or you get promoted or something like that. But you just kind of gotta put in your time as a director, and then everything that you learn as director is gonna help you as VP or a C-level person. So it's just something everyone, I guess, has to go through.
Yeah.
Is one of, yeah, those things.
What's the ideal outcome of thought leadership content? Is it actually to cause debate, to cause comments, to basically fuel conversation? Is it embodied in some sort of a metric that you can track, or is it more like ineffable, untrackable?
I think thought leadership at its core is untrackable because it doesn't fit in that box of, we're ranking number one, we got this many metrics, or we got this many views on the thing, we got this many signups, we got this many stuff. Because in my opinion, thought leadership should be used to build your brand, to build your influence in whatever space you're in, not really convert people to a signup or to buy something. Like it can be used in that buyer journey to like get people interested or get people on your email list, and then you sell to them later. But it never should be used like, hey, we just published something on conflict resolution, and it shouldn't be like, read this whole thing, now sign up for one of our programs. That's not a one-to-one thing. It's like, oh, I know Reforge has a lot of content on improving my career, improving me as a manager, all this stuff. I'll subscribe to their blog. And then maybe one piece hits in 3 months that they're like, fits me perfectly. And then they sign up.
I think that's right. It's, yeah, like an input to the system, and it can be an input into your SEO efforts or, yeah, your sales efforts. And it's like, maybe it's that salience, you know, just brand recognition, brand recall, maybe, yeah, it's backlinks. If something's controversial enough, surely other people are going to reference that and link to it.
Yeah.
And then perhaps it's something like an email list where people are just intrigued enough where they're like, I want to hear what this person has to say, because it's so outside the mold of what most people are saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I was at Foundation, which is my previous role, like that was our whole thing, is like, I'd write these teardowns on companies, and the goal of it was just to get people to the email list and to prove that like we're a killer agency. We know what we're talking about. Here's how we break down all these strategies and stuff like that. So it was very thought leadership, but there was never goals like, oh, we need to get people to download this $50 template or something like that. It was always brand building and just getting more eyeballs on our content, on our brand, all that stuff.
So you worked at two of the best known content promotion companies, at least in my world, Vengage in terms of SEO and link building. And Ross is, of course, like, yeah. I feel like he's the best known voice when it comes to content repurposing and content promotion.
Yep.
What did you learn from those experiences?
So Vengage, I mean, I was at Vengage for 5 years. So I learned basically everything there is to know about SEO from them because when I started there, Eugene, our founder, came to Nadia and said, hey, here's what SEO is. She had no prior knowledge. Figure it out. And then we figured it out. And then she hired me and Sarah a couple months later. And we basically just built the entire strategy from scratch. There was not, I think I was hired at number seven, employee number seven. So like there was no playbook. There was nothing. And we just like hacked on it and then built out our own internal playbooks. And we built this whole thing. So like I learned from like how to start from nothing and how to scale it. And then how to enter new niches, new industries, stuff like that. And also how to go after like kind of adjacent categories as well. Like we started going after, before I left, color palette generators and stuff like that, where we didn't exactly have it, but we were building it and we wanted to get people excited about it. And that, I think last time I checked, that was like one of the most trafficked articles from SEO still. And then we also did, what was great about what I learned at Vengage is you can't only do SEO type content to build your SEO strategy. You need this other thing, which we called the viral or hybrid content. And it was our data-driven pieces that we published, surveys that we do, co-marketing stuff that would get us links, guest posting. You need all those other things to support that SEO push. And like we would write stuff, like I wrote for 5 years straight graphic design trends article, and it ranked number one for basically all those 5 years. And it was an extremely competitive space, but it allowed us to link to some of our less interesting things like timeline infographic template and write guest posts where we could sneak those links in. So it kind of taught me how to do SEO from the ground up and how to think about SEO as a whole thing instead of just trying to rank on a keyword.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a basket of bets is how we put it. It's like you're familiar with our barbell strategy, which is sort of the portfolio model. And a lot of people get disappointed after a couple months of doing content.
Yeah.
The man gen side is like, hey, we're printing all this SEO content and we're not actually ranking and it's not succeeding. Why? And then if you're doing brand content, thought leadership, and you're only doing the viral buzzworthy stuff, you're like, well, it's not converting. It's not generating revenue. Why? And it's like, well, because those are two pieces of a composite puzzle, like something total, where especially in the beginning days, like if you have no domain rating, you have no audience, how do you think you're going to compete against these juggernauts? Like if you're going against HubSpot, if you're going against Reforge without something that stands out and can actually build links. And we call that buzzworthy content. I love the hybrid content, the brand content. Yeah. And then there's the product led and SEO stuff. And it's like, depending on your company stage and your strengths and how much, you know, revenue and how much you can invest in it, that portfolio could look differently. But the fact that it's a portfolio is the important part.
Exactly. You got to have this whole thing. And that's one thing that since I started at Reforge is just like expanding from just thought leadership to like different types of content. Because Brian's been doing like kind of, Brian and some of our experts have been writing that deep 5,000, 6,000 word thought leadership. It's great and it gets a big impact, but like there's other ways we can do content.
Was it a challenge? I know there's been a long time since these early days of Brian, his blog kind of launching the Reforge model in business, but was it a challenge to transition from people maybe expecting Brian's voice on all the content within Reforge to having more of a portfolio of different authors and editors? I ask because that was a little bit of an issue at CXL. Like eventually our writers, such as myself, like we built our own brands, but
exactly.
You know, when we started, it was like Pep was the voice of CXL. So it was, yeah, it was kind of a hard transition there.
Yeah, I think we haven't seen, I mean, just like any strong founder-led company, you're going to see some pushback on when it shifts from only founder, like you said, to all these other people. We haven't seen massive shifts though with it, just because the content we're putting out is super valuable. Like, mm-hmm, when we started adding these people in, like the content that makes it out into kind of the blog, into our email subscribers, is just so high bar that it still brings value. So I think even when you're switching from kind of a founder led or like, it doesn't even have to be founder, but just like a thought leader in your company, running all the content, sending all the emails, you just got to make sure that bar is at the same level. If it drops off a lot, that's when you lose your subscribers. But if it's consistently good content that the people who've subscribed will get value from, I think you can kind of like weather the storm of the transition.
Mm-hmm. The only thing is that system becomes a little bit fragile because it depends fully on the talent of the people on the team.
Yep.
Whereas like another company, like, I'm not saying HubSpot lacks talent, but like it is a system, right? Like you can plug new people in, you can plug freelancers in, you can plug guest contributors in, and the system's still going to produce results. Whereas a system like this, or when I was at CXL, is heavily reliant on the person behind the wheel.
Yeah. And I saw that kind of that happened when I was at Foundation, because it was like shifting from Ross to me. And thankfully, like I know how to kind of work the Twitter algorithms and stuff like that. So it wasn't a massive change, but it was a change. I mean, he goes from, what is he at, 50,000 followers? I'm right at 4 or 5. So that's a big thing, a big change. But just, I think I was able to keep the quality very high with everything we published. So that helped kind of that transition. So yeah. But now that I'm gone, I haven't really kept up with it, but I think he's doing fine, because he's back and leading it.
You don't get the schadenfreude of saying like, oh, we wish you were still here. We can't do it without you.
Yeah. Just sometimes that's always my theory. You're just like, oh damn. But yeah, I've learned a lot from both companies. And I think it brings a lot of value to Reforge, because I've done it before, or we've done it before. So that's cool.
So how are you looking at content promotion now in terms of Reforge's content? You mentioned going after some lower traffic keywords and some higher ones, and doing like more of an expertise led thing, but how else are you getting distribution for the stuff you're writing?
It kind of fits into that like controversial take we talked about, where we know our stuff is going to be shared basically across the product space, across growth marketing, across all these things that we have a foothold in. And we have a lot of very happy evangelists that share it. And then even the people who write it, like, I know a post we put out a couple of weeks ago, the writer shared it and it just like took off just from one LinkedIn share. And these are the people, again, these are these experts that have multiple tens of thousands of followers. So we've kind of got that built in distribution channel, but we are kind of building a more plug and play thing where we can put content in and it'll get distributed to the right people. But again, that's a big ongoing process.
How do you choose which experts to include in content, whether it's like a roundup, like you talked about with the managing up piece, or if it's somebody who, I think you just referenced somebody who wrote their own piece. Do they come to you with a piece like yours? I'm sure you've got a hand selected cast and crew where you're like, these people probably know about this because they've been executives, but what's your system for working with experts?
So we have EIRs, which are executive in residence. They help build the programs. They're here for the events. They're all that. They're pretty happy to write things. They pitch us a lot because they will come up with this couple sentence idea. And then we, as managing editors, me and Taryn, help them take that from a tiny idea, a tiny pitch, maybe a couple paragraphs of like, I want to write about this, to a full post. And like our editing is very deep where we help them get it from that single idea to like a full 5,000 word blog post. And I'm really proud of like our editing stuff, because I feel like everything we take from start to finish is helping them get their voice out there. Because again, a lot of these people aren't writers. I mean, Adam Fishman isn't, Elena maybe is, all these people that work for us aren't trained writers. They're in the product there. They have all these great ideas. They just need a little help getting them out there.
Interesting. So this is a different form of editing than just polishing up the style. If I came to you and I was like, hey, I want to write a piece on why most companies don't need an experimentation team. Like, that's maybe a contrarian take. I think people hire too early for that position. Yeah. I've got some hashed out ideas, but I haven't fleshed out the piece. How would you work with me on that?
So first I would be like, okay, let's outline this. We know we need an intro. We need a conclusion. We know we need to like set up why someone should care about that. And then the messy middle of all the stuff. But what I think I've figured out is like, there's a lot of content out there that you can go look at and be like, oh, it's not exactly what we want to write about. It's not the exact topic, but you like this flow that mm-hmm. you intro the problem, you agitate it, and then you solve it. So like using that helps them, I think, a lot, because then they can kind of just like write notes underneath each header, and then it just evolves instead of just like looking at a blank page. I've done that a few times where they're like, I have this idea. I want to repurpose this thing from the program. I'm like, okay, going into the program, I'll go see what it is. And I pull out the outline based on what that role is, but they want to write it for a different role. So we've already got this nice little outline that we can follow of this is part three.
Are you creating the outline, or are they creating it with your help?
I'm creating it just because it speeds it up. I mean, I've made so many outlines. It just makes it a lot easier to give them something and be like, hey, fill this out. It'll help you get your kind of ideas clear and in the right order. And then we can start working on the first draft. And then from the first draft, we do the like deep edits. We do the like, oh, we need more here, we need more there. And then we get it ready to go over the next couple of weeks.
Gotcha. And then as you're nearing the finishing stages of that first draft, or maybe like the between the stages between the first and second draft, let's say that I am a horrible writer, but I'm a very charismatic speaker and I've got all these mannerisms. I say y'all because I live in Texas. Yeah, I crack some silly jokes, all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
How do you incorporate that? Because if I'm not a good writer, maybe I still write like an academic college essay style. How do you keep my voice intact?
Usually we have like a chat and I can pick up on those, because I do the exact same thing. I'm such a big fan of like, oh, you need to add personality. And that's like my biggest note is like, add your personality. People want to read what you have to say. One of our authors a couple of weeks ago, it was very academic. And I'm just like, you have all this experience, talk about it, just throw it in here. And she added 1,000 words to it, just a personal experience. And it made it so much stronger, because I think people are stuck in that academic writing thing, which I totally get, of like, oh, the last time I wrote was like a college paper, so I'm going to follow that structure. But you can be like, yeah, throw your personality into it, throw your colloquialism, throw anything, any of your experiences that you have into it. It'll make it so much stronger, and people will connect with you a lot easier when they're like, oh, I see that they ran into that problem too. Here's how they solved it. Instead of just like, you could solve it like this. You kind of got to set up the examples with your own experience.
Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts on this. This is great. Nassim Taleb, author of Anti-Fragile, Skin in the Game, The Black Swan, talks about this. And I think Anti-Fragile, he talks about how he tests his editors. And if basically they spend all of their time polishing up his language and like making it homogenized and like middle brow, then he fires them immediately. Like, they're not a good editor for him, because not only, I mean, it's a negative to remove his voice, right? People want to read his voice, but it means that they're spending all of their mental effort and energy on those things and then missing the developmental things that actually make the piece worth reading.
Exactly. Yep.
So I won't say I'm anti-style guide, editorial style guide, but I am anti-editorial style guide, how most companies do it, which is like 5 pages of like very specific and concrete details on how you should write your sentences, what style it should be in. And it's like, I don't know, give me some guardrails. Like, there is a certain style of content. You know, the Atlantic has a certain style, the New Yorker has a certain style. but you recognize Malcolm Gladwell's voice versus other New Yorker articles, right? Like there's enough nuance and enough wiggle room in there that you're not trying to control and polish off every little thing. So it hits this like corporate friendly yet informal, yet, you know, it's like this just blah middle ground.
Exactly. And it ties back to what we were talking about earlier about like, how's Google going to tag you as being the author if you sound like it was written by a robot?
Yeah. Like, I also just wonder how much time people are wasting on stuff like this. You know, it feels like work for work's sake. Is it moving the boat faster? Probably not.
No. Yeah. I'm all about like having like lanes that you play in. I feel like I say that all the time, no matter what I'm talking about, like repurposing content, always lanes to play in. Writing, give them lanes to play in, but give them that wide lane where you're like, okay, we're going to not talk about this and we're not going to talk about this, but in here, go crazy. And then you can pull them back. Like that's a good editor, I think, is if you like give them that space, because some of the best ideas come out of just that open play time where they're like, oh, I could write about this. And then it goes down this great trail instead of like only write about that.
It makes it more fun for a writer too, doesn't it?
It does.
To be able to add in little inside jokes, little turns of phrase. I used to do that all the time with Chanel at CXL. We'd put little jokes in for each other, you know, and they'd maintain until publication. And it was so much more fun to write and edit.
Yeah. And then just like, they're proud of it too. Cause they're like, that's my,
this is me.
Yeah. That's me. That's me doing it. That's me sharing it. That's me. That's my insight. I came up with that myself instead of like when you get everything filed down to just like a sentence. And it's just like, sounds like you said, corporate speak that doesn't mean anything.
I'm going to follow up with a bit of a grandiose question. Because we've been touching the edges of this issue as most conversation around content do, but I'll just ask straightforward, like what does quality content mean to you?
That is such a hot button question that I get asked all the time. And I don't think there's a single answer. I think quality content depends on your goals. I think that's what people forget, is like always tie it back to your goals. Do you want to get more email subscribers? Okay, then write something that gets people to that edge, or you give them a template or something like that and they want to give you their email. If you want to get more shares, write smaller content, create content that's shareable, stuff like that. Like you have to think about what you want content to help you get to instead of just using content as the goal. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, like when I was like interviewing and then when I came to Reforge, a lot of people that I talked to, and this is going to be kind of a controversial take, is like a lot of companies are looking for, I was calling it a content savior. They want you to come in and fix everything with content. And that's not what content is for. That's not what it should be used for. It should be used to like elevate things that are already happening, not pull you out of this tailspin because something isn't working. It can do that, but it's going to take 3-4 years to get there.
What do you mean? Can you explain more about this content savior thing and like maybe some red flags as to tell if somebody's looking for that? I'd love to learn more about that.
It's funny. I recorded an entire podcast with Bridget and Sarah, the self-control and cheese one, about hiring red flags. And there's some good insights in that. But okay, for example, one person I interviewed was like quoting skyscraper technique, and like, and I was like, that was like 6 years ago. Like, what are we doing? And I don't know if I want to be this controversial. They're pulling stuff from like very low level content things and then trying to trip you up on those questions. Cause I felt like they were trying to trip me up on like, do you know what skyscraper is? I'm like, not really. And then when you describe it, I'm like, oh, that is such an old tactic. I would never call it skyscraper. I'd do my own thing. But if they don't really understand where content fits in it and they're using a lot of buzzwords, immediately like, oh, we saw that content is important because all these people are hiring for content. People are hiring in our space for content. We want a content person. But they don't realize what you're going to do. Or they give you like 12 jobs, which is the other side of it. Where they're like, oh, we want you to run this social, do video, do all of this stuff.
But they expect results like next month and they've been flat for like 3 years. And it's like, well, how do you think that I do? Do I have a magic wand? Like,
that's what it was. It's like, they wouldn't give you time to, they didn't understand that content takes time. They understood that, understood it almost in like turning on an ad campaign. Like, oh, yeah. You can get results from an ad campaign because it just turns on.
Which also isn't instant, by the way. Like there's a lot of those things that people think, like content is definitely a slower game.
Yeah.
But people still expect too much from ads, and also experimentation. Like I've heard so many companies who think like, because you're an experimentation or a CRO expert, that you should come in with ideas that are generating higher conversions. And it's like, well, if I knew the answers, I would just give them to all the companies, charge a shitload of money and retire. Yeah. You know, like the process, that's how we find these ideas that win.
Yeah.
So I think that instant gratification is rampant across the board, but especially with content and SEO.
Yeah, I think it's a new, I don't want to say new, but it's kind of new as a function, as like for some companies, like they might've had sales, they might've had advertising, might've had PR, but they never really had that content. Or the content that they put out was all driven by all those other people. And they don't really understand where it fits into it because they built their company around other things. And when you come to a company like Reforge, or like when I was at Vengage or even Foundation, content was at its core. And Brian understands the power of content. Like that's, Reforge is built on content. So he knows how valuable it is. And that's, and it's just everywhere you look, it's like content, content, content. Here's the value of content. Here's all this stuff. So that's really what intrigued me to come here, is like they knew what they wanted to do with content instead of just like having these like, oh, I read this article that said you could do this with content.
It's amazing how much of this mimics my experience with clients, and or not clients, but prospects.
Yeah.
Because we had to learn these red flags as we went along. And I think we avoided many. We made a couple mistakes, but largely it was obvious to me when somebody was like, they didn't understand content. They didn't have the time. They didn't understand where it fit in their organization, like what they were going to do with it. You know, if we drive a bunch of traffic, like, do you have mechanisms by which you can convert that traffic and actually monetize it?
Yeah.
So one of the big things now that we look for is having somebody internally, they don't have to be a content leader, they could be a marketing leader, but somebody who isn't the founder, who actually understands and places this stuff in the proper context.
Yeah.
Because earlier on, like we would have a founder who maybe read that content was important, maybe went to a conference, maybe looked at HubSpot's blog, and they're like, we need to do that, but we don't know why or how, you know?
And we don't have the goal of what it's going to accomplish. I think that's what a lot of people are missing too. They're like, we want content. What's it going to do? No clue. You get to figure that out. I'm like, maybe not.
Exactly. Did you go right into content marketing after you graduated, or do you have any stepping stones? Because I know you mentioned you studied economics.
Yeah. So studied economics. I did kind of like consulting. I built my own tech site like right out of college and scaled that up to like 50,000 organic sessions per month, which was insane back then.
What was the site about?
It was like a tech review site. It was like, I launched it right when like Product Hunt and Kickstarter and all these things were launching like 100 new apps a day. And I went through and I'd pick out like the best 8 that someone should pay attention to, and then built out these lists and stuff like that. It doesn't exist anymore. I think somebody bought the domain.
Oh man. I was like, dude, if you're getting 50,000 sessions a month, like you could print money on affiliate links.
Oh, I know. I was so dumb. I just shut it down because I got tired of doing it when I joined Vengage. And now looking back, I'm like, you big old idiot. You
could have scaled that. That's so funny.
Yeah. I had no context from it. But I learned so much about it. I learned how to build WordPress. I learned a little bit of SEO. I learned how to build things on social, do all the design stuff on Canva, that kind of stuff. So it was a great like trial by fire, because I'm just like, I really don't want to go to grad school for economics. I'm going to just jump into the startup world. And it taught me so much so quickly. And it was almost like a sink or swim kind of thing. Like, you got to figure it out or it's not going to work. And all that stuff kind of helped me propel to Vengage, and then it's stuff that I still use to this day.
Do you think about like nerdy shit, like the diminishing marginal utility of increased backlinks, and like the supply and demand curve of like writer costs versus like the expected value of a piece of content? Has economics ruined your view and made it completely unartistic in relation to content?
Sometimes I think too deeply about the data part, but I also think that's a really important thing to have, is like thinking about what the diminishing return of a viral piece of content is going to be, and how do you keep that going, and how do you build out how do you build out a strategy around that where 3 months from now, it's still getting traffic because you built all these affiliate links or you built all these guest posts and stuff like that? I'm always thinking about supply and demand curves because like I had this professor who had these massive 4 whiteboards and he'd draw how everything interacts on each graph. And I've got that like burnt into my brain. And every so often I'll think about those. And like, if this moves, then this will move. And I think that's a good thing to remember too. Like if you increase your spend on this, things will move. Like there's a bunch of things moving, but it might not take you to where you want to be.
Yeah. I mean, I think about this stuff all the time. This is the angle by which I view content, which is a little bit obnoxious, but yeah. You also at Reforge, you've innovated on this model, this growth model concept, right? Like that's introducing economic concepts into growing companies, which yeah. Growth was always a little bit more quantitative, but I feel yeah. like in content and SEO, maybe SEO, but content, people don't often look at it like that. They look at it as sheer like inputs, like how many articles are we writing without thinking about like, well, if we wrote fewer articles and spent more money on promotion, like what would the output be, yeah. you know, and once you start building a model, you start to see some of those things. So
yep.
Seems like you're in the right place.
Yeah. I think every company, when they spin up content, it happened at Vengage. It's happened at Foundation too. Like when they're like, we need to double our, it's always, I'm going to double our content. It's always that. And then you don't realize it's like a 6x amount of resources that you need to get to that double content, because you can't just have one person. You can't just add like another writer. Like, That doesn't work. Like they're exhausted. You can't, I like to say, you can't squeeze any juice out of an onion once you get to the end of it. Like just adding another onion, you're still going to get less juice. I don't know. That was a mixed metaphor, but
I'm a big fan of mixing colloquial sayings and metaphors.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
Yeah.
Who are you chasing? What's your long game? Where are you going with your career? Like, what do you want to do?
Man, I don't know. That's I love being at Reforge because it's such a, I mean, like, I feel like it's going to transform like how people grow their careers. And I love being at companies who have that, like that really solid message. They know what they're doing. They know where they're going. They've got smart people that are helping you get there. That's how it was at Vengage. And I don't know. I love doing content. I think I'll always have to produce content, even if I'm in a VP role or something like that, where I'm not doing much on the ground. It's just, I guess I have a lot to say, and writing just comes so easily to me. So I think I'll always be a writer in some sense of the word, if it's threads, if it's doing stuff on TikTok, shit. I don't know where it's going to take me, but I think there's this running joke at Vengage, and I'm guessing it's probably going to pop up at like, at Reforge too. Is like, I just want to live on a farm. Like, mm-hmm. like get me to that. That's all I want to do. Like I have massive vegetable garden in my backyard. I've got plants everywhere. It's not so many because I've moved everything outside now that it's the summer, but like if we were recording this a month ago, you'd see like 30 plants back there. So
is this a new pandemic thing, or has this always been a wish of yours?
Yes. So I think my parents were always big, like outdoorsy gardener people. And I always just enjoyed that. And I think I enjoyed even more being in tech because it's so different. Mm-hmm. You're working with your hands, you're building stuff. It's so tangible. And when you're like writing an article, it just exists in like ones and zeros and images and stuff like that. So I like it because it's such a different thing, and you can kind of turn your brain off. Like it's very like, oh, I need to trim this bush. Oh, I need to cut down that limb. Like you're just like, got it, easy. But I think the plant expansion definitely was pandemic related, because I'm just like, I need some green in my house.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think when I sell the agency for billions, I'm gonna go get a plot of land somewhere, you know, maybe in the mountains, and
I feel like
it'd be like that Presidents of the United States song, like move into the country and eat a lot of peaches. That's all I want to do. Write some books, maybe, you know?
Yeah. That's
like, I mean, a little bit of a prosaic life.
Yeah. Like write a marketing book, eventually sell that, and then just do recurring revenue from that. But I just planted like 4 peach trees in my backyard. So I'm getting close to that.
It sounds like the mission is important to you, but also like what I'm reading between the lines here is that the actual creative process is something that drives you as well. Yeah. Simply creating something from zero to one.
Yep. I love, And that's what I really liked about Foundation and writing those teardowns is like, I got to put my, I called it my marketing detective hat on. And I would like, cause I would just start from like, oh, why does that company do that? Like my most famous one was, I saw that Grammarly was ranking on a bunch of misspellings with their content. I'm like, that's really weird. Why are they trying to rank on like the misspelling of like, I think it was like there versus they are, all those things. I'm like, that's really weird. And they're running ads on it too. I'm like, that's even weirder. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that they built this like really smart acquisition engine where people go to search that, they click it. And instead of pushing people to the content, they've got this pop-up that pops up immediately. It says, basically it says like, never want to think about this again, install Grammarly. And I'm like, holy, that is the smartest little acquisition. And they're using content in the right way, because the whole reason for the content is to get ranking number one. Like, they don't care if people read that content. That's not the end goal. The end goal is get that pop up in front of as many people as they can. And I just wrote a whole teardown on that, and just figuring that out, I was like, oh my God, I cannot wait to share this with people because it's so smart. So
I love that stuff. I love clever. I love the growth hacks. I love whatever people are calling it nowadays.
Yeah.
I love the blending of creativity with acquisition, business focused. And if you can include content as well, like some of my favorite things that I did at HubSpot was like, we had a lot of templates type posts as well.
Yeah.
We had the sales tools. So it'd be like, you know, sales follow-up templates. And we just thought like, what's the intent of this? Probably a salesperson coming and copying, pasting.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out like we've got tools for this. We've got a snippets tool. We've got a sequences tool. We've got all these different things that can automate that, so they don't have to copy and paste every time. So first we looked, and you could set up a Google Tag Manager tracking trigger where it like, it shows you when people copy something to the clipboard, and it shows you what text. And sure enough, you know, a very large percentage of people were copying and pasting from those blog posts. So then the follow-up there was then we could, once somebody copied, trigger a pop-up that says tired of copy and pasting, like use this free tool.
Yeah.
And I love those little areas that, you know, people aren't typically thinking about. They're kind of in plain sight, but you don't notice them until you're like, wait, there's a lot of space here to potentially acquire some customers.
Yeah. And I think really that's what sets me apart from content people is I'm like insanely curious all the time. Like, part of the reason I got into all these plants was just like, can I grow that? Like, I have an olive tree, I have a grapefruit tree that I grew from a seed. I'm like, can I do that? Let's figure this out. Let's learn about it. Let's do all that. I think that's what drives me at my core as a content creator. I just want to learn more. And that's what I love about Reforge is I learned so much just editing these pieces that I'm going to use for the rest of my career, probably.
I think curiosity is the most underrated trait of probably anybody, but specifically content marketers. So we were talking about like hiring internally at the agency and like what makes a good writer and all this stuff. And we started reflecting on our own careers, and myself specifically at CXL, I was like a little bit thrown into the deep end. Like, I hadn't worked in a tactical role. Like, experimentation is very technical. But how I did it, and Pep was a great mentor, but like the management infrastructure was not something that you would get at Google. You know, there was no onboarding, there was no training program, nothing like that existed. The way I did it was I nights and weekends, I was reading as much as I could. I was pulling books. I was going to coffees. Like, I got nearly obsessed with a lot of this stuff, with like decision theory and psychology and all these related fields, because I wanted to learn it. Like, there was something just innate and interesting about what I was learning. And I think that came out in the content at the time.
Yeah. I say that. I like the best content creators are either like ex-journalists or they're just insanely curious no matter what their background is. Like, they want to just learn more and more and more, and they want to share it with people. I think that's another thing is like, you got to be curious and you want to be willing to like share what you found.
Yeah. I want to do some more personal rapid fire questions, but first I want to ask just so I don't miss this. We've talked about some contrarian ideas already, but I always like to ask what do you believe about content marketing that most people would disagree with you about?
I think that, okay, we'll go deep. I think 90% of content is unneeded. I think that a lot of people are putting stuff out to rank number 8. Instead of and constantly updating that to get to number 3, to get to number 2, when they could be investing that in building a whole new category or investing in social or something like that. I think that just because there's appetite for 50,000 people searching, if you're on the second page, that doesn't matter. And mm-hmm. if you don't have an infrastructure to build out to get to number one, number two, number three, then maybe you should tweak your goals instead of just constantly kind of like going after that white whale. Like, oh, we want to rank number one because this will change everything. And they spend a year getting there and then get knocked off on a Google core update and they never get back to it. So building different, and this is one thing that we ran into at Vengage that got really tough when Canva decided to invest so much money in SEO. Is like, we put all of our eggs in the SEO basket, and then we didn't really have like a very strong brand to fall back on when Canva started ranking number one for all these things, because they had a 1,000-person link building team basically that could go get any link they wanted.
I think you hit on an important strategic issue, which is like, instead of framing the question like, how can I play, like how can I do SEO, how can I do paid, how can I do X, you got to reframe it to how can I win. And yep. if you don't have an answer for that, then you should wait to play, you know. And some yep. of the trial and error, you know, you're going to learn as you go, but you should have a pretty clear answer as to like how you specifically with your resources feasibly are going to win by doing this.
Yeah 100%. And just don't make bets on like future hires or like where the industry is going, because you have no idea. COVID hit. I mean, we might go into like a recession. I don't think it's going to be as bad as everyone thinks, but still, like, make bets that are sustainable instead of like the flash in the pan ones.
Mm-hmm. All right. You ready for some personal rapid fire stuff?
Yep. Hit me.
Have you listened to the podcast before? Do you know what questions?
I came in blank because I wanted to just.
This is good.
Yeah.
I repeat some of them. So who do you admire professionally and why?
Oh, our CMO, Joanna Lord. I think she is one, the nicest marketer you'll ever meet. And two, like insanely smart. Like the thing she says about marketing just like boggle my mind in the best way. And she's just like, she's such a personable CMO. Like if you need anything, you can shoot her a message and she'll respond. And just the things that she's built and all that stuff. And she's just, like I said, she's like the nicest person I've ever met. So
yeah, that's cool. I saw her speak at a conference many years ago. I used to quote her in many of my articles too. So she was one of my expert voices when I was at CXL.
Yeah.
If you could create your own category in Jeopardy, what would it be? And would you get every question right?
It would definitely be plant identification by like the outline of it. And I'd probably get most of them right.
Really?
Yes.
But you said you kind of recently got into this, right?
Yeah, but I also dug deep. I have like 250 plants.
Wow. Yeah. Like, I'm jealous of that actually. Like when I go for walks, I always think like it'd be really cool to know what all of these plants are, especially the poisonous ones, you know.
Yeah. I think I'd be really good at it. Like I'm just looking around here at like all the ones that are on my desk. I'm like, yeah, I could probably tell that by the outline. Yeah, I could probably do that. I think that would be good. I'm trying to think of anything else that I have like weirdly insane knowledge about. Probably just plants.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Which talent would you most like to have?
Ooh, I played saxophone when I was little, but I wish I could play piano. I don't know why I just skipped to saxophone, but just, I love music so much and just seeing people just being able to like jam, like even if it's not a real song on a keyboard or whatever, I'm like, I could do that. But also I could learn how to do that.
Mm-hmm. It just takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
I'd also like to be able to play piano better because it's impressive. Like if there's a piano at a house or like a party or something like that, and somebody just plays really well, I'm like,
yeah,
oh, it's amazing. And it's way cooler doing that than if you rip out a guitar at a party, then you're just, you know, the asshole with the guitar.
Yeah. 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 That's one thing that I've been wanting to learn. I'm trying to think. Yeah. That's like my one big thing that I'd want to learn.
That's a good one. Do you consider yourself more scientific or artistic?
That's tough because like I got my degree in econ, but like I'm super creative at the same time. Like I'll just build a shelf. I did it a couple days ago. Just like, oh, I need this for this. And I'm like, okay, I can see everything in my head. And I just went and built it for all my plants. I don't know. I think I'm in that right middle area where like I have enough of each where I don't get pulled either way, but I can make like informed decisions from each side. I know that's
We've got the perfect mix right here because you're a writer by trade and yet you're a botanist by hobby. So we've got the perfect mix.
Yeah.
This is maybe not a rapid fire one, but what do you consider the most overrated virtue?
This one's going to be controversial too, I think.
This one should be controversial, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. I think, I don't know how this is a virtue, but like the people are like obsessed with like getting up early.
Mm.
Like look down on people because they're like, oh, you started your day at 9 o'clock. I was up at 5 a.m. I'm like, okay, well, I also work till midnight. We're doing the exact same thing. I don't know what that would be, like early risers. I think
get annoyed by the whole morning routine people.
Yeah.
I used to be one of them. Like I used to, you know, have to do my like rigid like 20 minutes of meditation, followed by journal, followed by like bulletproof coffee and all this stuff. And then I was like, this is stupid. I'm just going to do what I want to do in the morning. Like this is over optimizing my life.
Yeah. I don't know what that would be. Maybe personal over optimization. That's something where people are like,
I do think that's overrated, by the way. Yeah. I really think that's overrated and it's glorified.
It hurts your brain. It hurts your creativity. If you're like, because some of my best ideas all come as I'm driving to my girlfriend's house or whatever, and I'm taking them down on my notes app at a stoplight, like, oh, I need to write about this, or while I'm working out. Like, I think that the distracted mind is like one of the most powerful things. And you have to have that time to be distracted. Like, I'll go out after this and I'm gonna go look at all my veggies and I'll probably come up with three great answers to one of your questions that I didn't even think about.
It misses the forest for the trees in almost every area. The productivity stuff, especially, I think that's the most obvious. Like we see that every day, with absent kind of minded time being important. But I see it in like health and fitness too. People who like wear continuous glucose monitors and track all of their sleep. And I'm wearing an Oura Ring, so I'm a little bit of a hypocrite. But in an Apple Watch, you know what I mean, though, when you track every little piece of your day, it's like you kind of forget the purpose of like going to the gym. And also you're overstressed, you know, like stress is probably number one killer that you're missing out on. And like all day, you're just stressed about every little glucose spike and every little, you know, you got like 30 minutes less sleep last night. Yeah. And now you're stressed about that. And to me, it's just missing the whole point of it all.
Yeah. One other controversial thing I do is like when I go to the gym, I have no goals. I just go and work out. Like I know a lot of people are like, oh, I want to hit a PR or whatever. I'm like, yeah, but then you're over optimizing it. You're not, I guess my reason for working out is just to clear everything out of my head, to get active, to get the heart rate going. And when you're like, oh, I want to hit 275 on squat or whatever in the next 30 days, then you're just like, it becomes an obsession. And I'm just like, then you're not really living life. You're not, not having the spontaneity that you need.
And you gotta listen to the body with stuff like that too. It's like, you gotta go with the waves and this is applicable to more than that. It's like with productivity, sometimes you have to ride the waves of momentum. Yeah. If you have an off day, like, and you force yourself to do the same thing that you would have done if you were full energy, that's not going to work. But yeah, it's like, if you go in thinking you're going to hit a PR and you're like running on 4 hours of sleep, like that's obviously not going to be the best thing for you. Cause I do the same. Like I try to just listen to my body, and then like days where I'm not expecting to do much. Like those are the days where I hit the best workout,
you know, same here.
And then I come back and I'm like, oh, that was amazing.
Exactly. You just like, you take the pressure out of it. And instead of like chasing that goal or whatever that you get obsessed with, and then you get mad at yourself if you don't hit it. I used to be one of those just from like an athlete growing up as an athlete. You're like always trying to hit those whatevers. And you lose your benefits of exercise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's a career choice that you considered but didn't pursue?
I about went to law school. I think I would have been great at it. I can talk anyone's ear off. And I think economics helped me like understand how everything fits together and how to build an argument and how to do all that. And I took the LSAT and all that and did well enough to get in, but I was just like, I don't want $70,000 of debt or whatever it was going to be. And I'm so thankful that I don't have it, because then I can make better career choices now. If after reforms, I want to take a year off, I could. I mean, it's it's something I look back on with like, I could have done it well, but then I would have been a completely different person.
Yeah. I at one point wanted to do that as well. I think in college, like you look at these prestigious careers, like there's a couple options that rise to mind. You're like, well, I'm probably not going to be a doctor. Like, you know, biology sucked. So, lawyer, like lawyer's the next one, or, you know, maybe finance is an econ major. I'm sure that was more of a salient option, but like, if you're anywhere near ambitious, like those things tend to cross your mind.
Oh yeah, for sure. And like my brother is in college right now and he's kind of running the same thing of like, oh, I want to go do this because I know that there will be jobs. Like he wants to do, I think it's biochemical engineering. And he's like, yeah, I want to go do this because that, and he's not really enjoying it as much as I think he thought he would. But there are jobs after that. And then there's me who didn't even know like content marketing was a thing in college until I got out and now I'm here. So it's like, sometimes the best job out there for you, you don't even know about it and you kind of fall into it.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're basically at time. I wanted to ask if you have anything left unsaid, anything you want to explore at this point.
Only thing is our summer cohort kicks off in a couple of weeks. And it's our first one, but we're super hyped about it. We got 3 or 4 new EIRs that are teaching some of the programs. So check it out at reforge.com.
Oh, and he drops the promo.
You have to drop it on the way out, but yeah.
All right. Well, let's do some self promo too. Tell people where they can find you online.
You can find me at Ryan McCready 1 on Twitter. I don't tweet as much as I did. I looked at my stats and I went from like tweeting 300 times a month to like 3 times. So I'm taking a self-imposed break on that just because I've got so many other things going on. But I do drop some good ones every once in a while. I think I tweeted that picture of Prince Lil, whoever, screaming at the celebration. And I'm like, when people ask you to write for exposure, and that did really well. So
I love it. Well, thank you so much. This is a super fun conversation.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I had a great time. We got very deep. It flew by. So yeah, I had a great time.